Hello and welcome to this podcast, Dyslexia Explored. I'm Darius Nomdaron, your host, and today I have got an award-winning jewellery designer who started out with a first-class degree at Brunel University in London, won a design prize in there, and since in her jewellery business, run a jewellery business in the UK, won 20 plus design awards and is now chair of the National Association of Jewelers. Or should I be more clear, she was chair and now she's vice chair and helping the new chair in her role. She's also written a book about starting a business if you're a creative, and she's a mum, and she's done all of this with dyslexia and would like to share a little bit of her dyslexia story with us. It's great to have Harriet Kelsall with us. Harriet, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you very much, Darius. That's quite an introduction. I better not be too rubbish now.
Oh, don't worry about it. You don't need to worry about imposter syndrome here. You know, it's all true. And I'm really looking forward to hearing your dyslexia story. And you know, I think there's a lot of creative people out there that want to be creative. They've got some dyslexia. They want to be practical. I bet you there's a lot of jewelers who are creative, who are dyslexic. It would just be lovely to hear your story from where it began, what your challenges were, and what your rewards have been in the end.
Yeah, it was interesting. When I was writing the book that you mentioned, I interviewed a lot of successful creative business owners, and it would, you know, just because they were great and I liked their business, or a couple of them I already knew, and actually what was fascinating was that when I was interviewing them, in so many of the interviews it came out that they were dyslexic. It was extraordinary that so many successful creative business owners are also dyslexic and three-dimensional thinkers. So it is very inspiring. It's such an advantage in what I do and what they do now. And it's really great to look at it that way, because it feels like such a disadvantage when people are dragging themselves through school. But actually, once you get over all those hurdles, it's a huge advantage in running a business and being a creative leader of any kind, to be able to do all of the things that dyslexia brings to us so naturally.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing your story. Where did it all begin for you? You know, before dyslexia was on your radar, what was life like? And then tell us what the wake up call was.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, I went to a sort of girls' high school in St. Albans, and it was a very good school. But of course, it was a long time ago, in the 70s and 80s, and dyslexia hadn't entirely been invented then. Well, it had, but people didn't really know about it. And I think back then, it's not like that now, but back then my school didn't really believe in it. So I'd never heard of it. I didn't know it was a thing. And so I just got on with school. But I found things really difficult. So I remember routinely getting 0 out of 10 or 1 out of 10 for my spellings in my junior school, and being really quite severely reprimanded for that, and also for writing illegibly and for taking too long writing things down. But nobody, you know, it wasn't an era where people would say, oh, maybe she needs a bit of help with her different ways of thinking about spelling. It just wasn't that. You just got told off, and that's how it was. And so it was a strange time, and I just didn't really think I was very good at anything at school, except I knew I was really good at art and maths because I got lots of praise for those two subjects. So I went through school in that way. And there were also, like every dyslexic person at school, you know, I have all sorts of horror stories of, I remember there was one teacher in particular who was just so utterly awful to me in my junior school, telling me that I'd, you know, must have cheated because I'd written a poem that was really good and I was far too thick to have written a good poem, and, you know, all of this kind of thing. So, you know, usual rubbish. And then when I went into the senior school, two girls joined the school when I was about 13, 14, who'd come from other schools, and they had previously been diagnosed as dyslexic. And it was interesting because the school wouldn't diagnose dyslexia or really, really recognize it. But once these girls came into the school and they had been diagnosed, they went off and did these special lessons. And that was quite interesting to watch. It didn't make them think any differently about dyslexia, but they obviously realized they had to provide some sort of facility for this. And And interestingly, these girls coincidentally were my best friends. And at the time, I probably should have thought maybe our brains work in the same way, but it just didn't occur to me. I didn't really know what it was. But actually, it was interesting because thinking back as an undiagnosed dyslexic in that environment, I remember being in the form room and Claire and Julie would go off to their special lessons, and there was never anything said about it, but there was always this sort of silence, like, oh, they're going off to the sort of thick room or whatever. And I now look back and think I was very pleased not to be diagnosed, because I think that that probably wasn't the best thing for those girls actually at the time, weirdly. So even though they were getting help on one hand, they were also, you know, developing a chip on their shoulder that wasn't their fault. So yeah, that was my experience at school. And so what I did was I avoided subjects with many words in, which was quite a good strategy, because it meant I, you know, gradually as you do your O-levels and then you do your A-levels and you sort of, these subjects kind of fall away that you have difficulty with. And so I was left with art and maths and science to sort of join them together. And that was a lot easier. But looking back again, I often feel a bit sad that I wasn't able to pursue English, because my English teacher was amazing. And she used to say, Harriet, you've got 8 spelling mistakes on every line, but what you're actually saying is brilliant. And so she was lovely. She used to give me in my classwork, she used to give me A's, even though I couldn't spell, because she loved what I said. But she said to me, you can't do the A-level. You just won't get through with the spelling. Because back then, again, they just didn't really understand about extra time and dyslexia. So I went for the subjects that I loved even more, actually, because I did love art and I did love maths, didn't really like science, but put myself through it to get going, and actually developed a real love for science later. And that was that. So went off to study industrial design at university at Brunel, because again, this was me sort of, you know, finding the subjects that my brain could do. And it wasn't until a lot later that I was diagnosed as dyslexic by my ex-mother-in-law, who was a specialist dyslexic teacher when I was about 28. And I thought, oh, that's what it was all about. But it was funny because, you know, I'm sure we'll talk later, but there were all sorts of things along the way that helped me and strategies that I developed. And I think when you're quite bright and dyslexic, you know, you can, even if you're not diagnosed, find these ways of helping yourself that you don't realise you're doing, and you feel a bit mad for the kind of crazy things you do to make yourself able to remember how to spell a particular word or something. But actually you do find those strategies. And what's great is that Dyslexic Help for Kids these days helps them with their strategies. And that's a wonderful thing.
Tell us a little bit about the strategies that you came across when you were a teenager.
Yeah.
Or a child, because a lot of the listeners will have children who are in the same situation as you. What did you stumble across?
Well, I think the first one I remember was when I was at junior school with my handwriting. My dad had noticed, obviously, that my handwriting was almost illegible. And he had also noticed that I really enjoyed watching my mum doing calligraphy, because she did it as a hobby. It was a big hobby in the 70s. And so he bought me a pen with a slightly calligraphic nib, and he bought me this lovely copy book. It was just a little, like an exercise book where you copy all the loops of letters and things like that. And he said to me, you'll do this just because it's really fun. It's kind of like calligraphy. And so I did, and I loved it, because it turned something that was a nightmare, which was writing, into feeling as if it was a part of a sort of piece of art forming each word. And that helped me enormously, because actually now I can write really quite legibly and quite nicely because of that, you know. And I loved it so much, I would do it for hours and hours. And so I actually got really good at writing, with a sort of trick to my brain of feeling as if it was an art thing rather than a communication thing, because I was copying other people's words rather than having to think about expressing something. So that was great. And then I think probably the second thing that comes to mind was that I used to, when I was at school, this is going to make me sound so mad, but, you know, we had to do things at school like learn a Shakespearean quote. because you couldn't, you know, look things up. So you had to learn some long Shakespearean quote in order to make some point that you knew was going to come up in the English exam. And learning a you know, three sentences of Shakespeare was impossible for me. I just couldn't remember the words. And so I used to use an acronyms a lot. So I would use the first letter of this quote and make up some silly rhyme about elephants or something that I could remember with the first letter of each word of the quote. And then when I wrote the letters down, then I could remember the quote. I mean, it's insane, isn't it? Why couldn't I just learn the quote? But I couldn't. But that craziness was probably about, you know, loads more work than learning the quote, but actually was my way of doing it.
Can I just explain to folk listening what I think you're explaining, you're doing there is you've got a quote that has those 30 words in it. You take each letter of the first letter of each word, turn it into like the, what would I know in Shakespeare? Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediment. Mm-hmm. Love is not love, which alters when it alteration finds. So I had to memorize that, but you would go, let me not, and it would be, you know, leaf,
llamas,
yeah.
Might not, you know, and so, yeah. You know.
And then you would create this story of abstract little things happening, and you'd remember the story, and then you would write down all the letters in the right order, and then exactly. You'd have the first letter of each word as a clue to remind you of what that word actually was. So you're not actually remembering the quote, you're remembering the story you created around the quote, and then you've got the scaffolding, and you start filling in the blanks, which is a classic dyslexic move.
And I did the same for learning things like the periodic table, because I had to learn sort of sections of the periodic table. And so, yeah, again, I had all sorts of things involving cats and, you know, mice. And I probably wonder if I could remember them now. I probably could. So, that was a big help for me. Something else that was a big help for me was that when I didn't get into the very posh secondary school that my sister was going to, my mum thought that I think she already had been thinking maybe I was just a bit thick. And so she took me to an educational specialist to have my IQ tested, because she just wanted to check whether I was actually just thick. And it turned out that I wasn't. I had a high IQ. And it didn't actually mean much to me, because I didn't really know what IQ even was, but it did mean a lot to my mum, and it helped her to understand that just because I couldn't do the things that she can do, it didn't mean I was thick, and that actually I just had a different kind of brain. And that sort of took a lot of the pressure off, and she stopped punishing me for not being able to spell so much. I mean, you know, that never goes away. People will still tease you mercilessly if you randomly forget how to spell the word put, and maybe they should, but you know, people can be really unpleasant about it. So she hadn't meant to be, but I think, you know, that changed a few things for me. So that was a big, and I always suggest to friends who have dyslexic kids, you know, do get their IQ tested, because it helps you understand them. It won't mean much to them, but it helps you respect them in a different way. And then another big breakthrough time for me was when I learned to touch type when I was about 17. My school offered this option where you could go and learn to touch type. And so I learned to do it, and I found it really difficult at first, but somehow it unlocked something in my brain. I think the three-dimensional aspect of using a keyboard rather than going along in a straight line for some reason helps. And it's interesting, whenever I speak to dyslexic people now who can also touch type, they always say, oh my gosh, that just changed my life, being able to touch type. And so now I always encourage people who ask me about it to get their kids touch typing really as early as possible, because it often, you know, opens up a big communication door that was locked shut before.
Fascinating. Fascinating. You've just talked about how valuable, sorry to cut you off there.
No, it's fine.
fascinating to hear how important the calligraphy and the handwriting was.
Mm.
And then also the touch typing.
Mm.
Because sometimes, I'd love to hear from your point of view, you know, sometimes if your child is a little bit dyspraxic or dysgraphic, and with dyslexia, we often have problems with our handwriting. It's very messy, very untidy, sometimes illegible. It takes a lot of brain processing to do it. So sometimes people think, right, you should just touch type completely instead. But there's my gut feeling and my personal experience with dyslexic is I kind of need both. Sometimes handwriting does something for me in terms of processing and contemplating things. And then sometimes touch typing is just great for capturing information and getting stuff out the head. What's your experience with that?
I love handwriting now since having done my copybooks for, you know, a few hours a week for a little while when I was younger. And so I do often choose to handwrite now as an adult. So I'll handwrite cards with a sort of italic pen, and I'll handwrite the lists that I live by because I'm always writing them and I enjoy the sort of process of writing bulleted lists and crossing things off with colours and that kind of thing. And of course, back at school, I had to handwrite because you had to handwrite all exams. There was no other option for you back then. So, but would it, you know, was I growing up, if I was growing up now, would I still value handwriting? Yes, I think I would. And I'm really glad I sort of went through that, because there is something very therapeutic, I think, about writing a line of text, even if you only write one line, and doing things like, because of course I'm often sketching, doing design sketches and things like that, and I have to annotate them for my customers with handwriting, and so often the kinds of things that we end up going into, we kind of sometimes do need to handwrite as well. So yeah, I wouldn't abandon handwriting in favor of typing myself. I don't think that's would have been the right thing to do.
Fascinating. Thank you for that. That's great to have that insight.
And another thing I found really helpful, I think I was telling you about this a while back, which is that when I got to revising for any kind of exams, what I would do is I would write my whole syllabus of each subject in really tiny writing with a rotaring pen, a very fine line rotaring pen, in black, onto these little colourful cards of paper that I had from some factory that school had taken us around in Women in Science and Engineering Week. So I had these paper samples. And so I would write my whole subject out in bullet form. And what I would do is I would go through each page of my actual notes that I had in my folders, and I would take things out from them and put them in these tiny words, and so each that the whole of the syllabus would eventually go on to maybe three or four sides of these tiny cards in tiny writing, and I would lay it out. I would put certain words in different colors or highlight certain words, or and I would write a certain type of thing, like a quote or actually usually an acronym by which I remembered the quote, in blue, and then I would write a formula, because I was also doing, you know, things with formulas in like maths, and in red. And so I had all these different colours. And so each tiny page would have a hell of a lot of information on it, usually in very condensed words that would remind me about the whole subject area. And then I found the layout of those pages would stay in my head. And so if I got a question on river, you know, river flow and what was an oxbow lake or something, I could sort of just think about that page and not exactly remember it exactly, but I'd say, oh, yes, it was on the top right of that page and it would be in green. And, oh, yes, I remember it was these 4 points. And so that was really helpful. Again, condensing the subject, just getting rid of all of the words that I could really, and condensing it into a small form that was very visual. And the process of doing that was the most important thing. And then the little cards, once I had them, by the time I was probably only a day or two away from my O-levels or whatever, they would just serve as my revision prompt. I could just look at them, take everything in. And if there was anything on there, I thought, oh God, what's that? Then I'd quickly look it up in my notes. But mostly that was then enough. So that was another strategy that I think would still be helpful today for dyslexic kids.
Yeah. And doodles on those as well, or were they just
a little bit, mostly words actually, but I did put some doodles on it. Lots of wiggly lines and kind of, you know, flowers, and some of the diagrams would be in little circles and things like that to just help me remember that part of the page. So yeah, color, lots of color.
This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com, which helps you organize yourself creatively with a productivity system for Apple devices. So we talked about what life was like before dyslexia, what the wake-up call was your two friends, and then also your mother-in-law, and then the challenge. What do you think has been your biggest challenge with dyslexia?
Well, there's so many, aren't there? Because, you know, like many other dyslexics, I mucked about in the subjects because I was bored, because often, even though I couldn't keep up with the words, the writing on the board, my concept wise, I was often way ahead. And so I had that. That was one of the challenges along the way.
Yeah. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Funny, because like I remember my mum asking me at school, how's school going? And I would say, it's too easy. And yeah. Then she'd go to the school and they would say, he's finding it really hard. He's not managing. And she's like, what's going on here? And I thought school was about understanding the subject and the concepts, but seemingly the teachers thought school was about memorizing the details. And I was like, why do you need to memorize the details? It's all about understanding life, isn't it? No.
Yeah, exactly. And so there was that. But I think really probably my main challenge was myself, in that I think I spent a lot of time at school trying to prove to myself that I was as good as other people. Mm-hmm. And I didn't spend enough time at school thinking about the things that came so easily to me. I was literally books and books ahead of everyone else in maths. And the science concepts were so easy to me, even if reading the questions, you know, reading the words on a science question was a tiny bit harder. And, you know, art, again, I could just do it. And so, but I never celebrated those facts. All I did was sort of, you know, think about how awful it was. I couldn't spell and I couldn't do this and I couldn't do that. And so I was really dwelling in the negative. And so even when I was at university, I think I became a bit of a workaholic in a way, because I was just sort of determined to tackle everything that came my way and find, sorry, this is my cat meowing in the background.
Fine.
And to find ways to get through that. And that meant that I probably worked in a bit of a crazy way when I think back. I mean, I would still have a good time, but it, you know, party as well. But it was just that sort of strange fixation on trying to be as good as other people without celebrating the things that came very easily. And now as an adult, that's something I talk about a lot to dyslexic people, because I think it's a really common error that everybody dwells all the time on the negative aspects of dyslexia and forgets to celebrate the things. It's like every disability. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine who helps out for CAMSight, which is a Cambridge charity for sight, for people with issues with their sight. And, you know, she was saying, the thing is, this is the same, you know, when somebody's blind, their hearing is so much better than everyone else's. So why shouldn't it be the same with dyslexia? Just because you can't spell, don't people realize that you're so much better at multitasking, you know, maybe music, it may be computer programming, those are all classic multitasking things, you know, and solving problems. We're so good at solving problems. We're so good at being entrepreneurs because we're so good at doing lots of things at once. Rubbish at doing one thing at a time, but brilliant at doing 20 things at once. And so, you know, that's what you need when you run a business. And so people don't often focus on the positive aspects of what it brings. And now that's something that, you know, that I'm very aware of, but the challenges still exist. So for example, I still find it really hard to know how to communicate to somebody when they berate me for example, not remembering a name, because I really struggle with it. And I really try, I know you do too. We talked about that before, didn't we? To just remember someone's name. And it can be somebody, I remember there was this amazingly talented designer I'd worked with for years working with me, and I could not get her name right. It was ridiculous. It was absolutely ridiculous. And she couldn't help, I'm sure. She was always really sweet about it, but she must have taken it personally, even though I knew everything about who she was and her design work. I could tell you everything about her life, but the name eluded me. And that's so common with dyslexic people. And yet people, you know, they will still not really cope with that, which in a way is understandable because it seems so rude when you can't remember someone's name. But I've learned techniques to do that, you know, repeating it 6 times in conversation with them in the first minute. And I talk to them and make a joke out of it and say, you know what, Darius, I'm actually going to say your name, Darius, quite a lot of times now, Darius. I know it's a little bit weird, but Darius, I need to remember your name, Darius, and this is how I'm going to do it. Okay, Darius. And, you know, and it's ridiculous, but, you know, I remember your name because that's what I did when I met you. So, so it works. So, you know, you do learn these crazy little strategies, but probably, you know, you do go through life as a dyslexic with everyone thinking you're just slightly crazy. And you probably just need to work out a way of being okay with that.
Yes. And double down on your strengths rather than double down on your weaknesses is exactly what I'm hearing as well.
Exactly. Exactly. And I mean, that's something that I've spoken to so many schools or dyslexic kids who their parents just haven't noticed, well, they have, but they haven't articulated or had articulated to them the positive aspects of their child's dyslexia. And so, you know, they've been in tears with me saying, I've just realised what you're saying, because everyone's saying, oh, you know, come on, little, you know, Flossie, you've just got to learn to spell, and no one's, and everyone, oh yes, you're very good at drawing those pictures, aren't you? And no one's actually realizing those pictures aren't just good, those are amazing. And you know what, she's going to be a great designer someday, or whatever she's going to do. But because we have to jump through these linear hoops, which is fair enough, you know, we do need to live in a world where there's only 10% of us dyslexics in this world, so we do have to figure out how to use it. But it's difficult, isn't it, when, you know, you're judged by a very linear thinking teacher, which is what I call so-called normal people, you know, typing away at a computer, sort of judging how good or bad you are at something by how well you can write in a straight line and how well you can read those words. And actually they're sitting there judging you on a computer that they never could have invented. But you know what? We can, you know, Steve Jobs, classic dyslexic. That's why he can invent these incredible, or could invent these incredible machines, because of his dyslexia. I don't think he would have been able to do that if he was a linear thinker, like the person judging me on the machine that he designed. Yeah. So I think it's really important to try and shed a different kind of light on dyslexia, because you know, we haven't died out yet. We must be bringing something useful.
Yeah. And Johnny Ives designed the Mac, and he went to industrial design college as well. He was the guy who invented the Mac, mm-hmm. invented the iPhone, invented the iPad, the Apple Pencil, and so on. So actually Steve Jobs managed to bring the right people together. He designed mm-hmm. people together, and Johnny mm-hmm. Ives designed the actual machines together, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Steve Jobs had a lot of the ideas. You know, I want it to be able to do this. Just go away and make it do that, because he knew what he needed it to be for him. And thank goodness, because we have these amazing machines now that are designed for brains like ours, because that's the things that Steve Jobs wanted them to do. You know, being able to speak to them and then type text and so on. Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's important. So challenges still exist, and I think that challenges still exist for all dyslexic people, but it's remembering that we have far more things to celebrate than to see as challenges.
You're a mum now. If you want to talk about it, your daughter's got some dyslexia, and you know, you're now in the same situation as so many of us.
Yeah,
I'm dyslexic. I'm a child. I'm a father of two people with children with dyslexia. And how's it like for you now?
Well, it's funny. I've got two kids, and Thomas isn't at all dyslexic. He's very, very good at spelling and things like that, he's the only person in our family that can spell. And Eleanor is dyslexic. But it's interesting. I don't understand either of them, actually. To have her being dyslexic doesn't help me understand her mind, because her mind's so different from mine. But it's interesting. And what I have managed to do, which I'm so proud of, I never sort of think of myself as a good parent. You just get on with it, don't you? But this one thing, about 6 months ago, she was laying the table for me, because we had some people coming over for a little get together, and it must have been more than 6 months ago, before lockdown, but anyway, sometime around then. And so she was getting all of we had crisps and dips and wine glasses and all sorts of things all over the table. And I'd just been chucking it on the table as I was making things. And she said to me, for goodness sake, mummy, be more dyslexic. You can do better than this. And I sort of, what? And she said, look at this table. It's a mess. For goodness sake, you need me to come and sort it out, don't you? You need to remember your dyslexic skills and stop being, you know, just getting on with making these things. And, I, you know, we laughed about it. And she says it every now and then, you know, I need to do this, Thomas. Get out of the way. I need to do this. This needs a dyslexic on the case. And so she's so proud of the things that she can do, like look at a table full of mess and make it beautiful really easily because of our three-dimensional thinking capacity that both she and I have. Sometimes I say to her, oh, can you please just organise this cupboard because Thomas has left it in a mess. And I mean, look, it's so linear. It makes no sense. You know, what? And she just goes, oh, for goodness sake. And she sorts it all out. And so she really celebrates her dyslexia, which is really important to me because, you know, we go through so much of life being having to do extra stuff and having to have extra time and having to be, you know, get lower marks, but somehow not feel too awful about ourselves as dyslexics, that if she can celebrate those moments, that's really good.
Yeah. So let's go on to some other details in that learning moments. You know, what are, you know, as an adult now, that you've got the freedom to learn the way you want to learn. You run your own business, you're chair of the, you know, associations and groups, and you're an entrepreneur. What are your learning styles? What are influential learning moments for you? Is it being with people? Is it being in groups? Is it courses? Is it videos? Is it YouTube? Is it books? How do you like to learn?
I like to learn from all different places, and I get bored quite easily if I'm doing something like just trying to look online or just trying to look in books or, you know, just trying to look at videos. So like the classic dyslexic brain, you know, I like to jump around all over the place. And I often liken dyslexic brains that the way we think to layers of an onion, because, you know, when we're solving a problem, like a business problem or starting a business even, or just solving a smaller problem, what we tend to do is we naturally start at the outside of the onion and we look at it holistically. And then we gradually step down and we don't know we're doing it sometimes, but what we're doing is we're going all the way around the outside of that problem. And then we gradually go into the center of the onion and that's our solution. And we do it in a way that is a bit bonkers to everybody else, because we'll be over one side of the onion 1 minute and the other side the other. And so we'll be saying, oh, what about marketing? Yeah, but hang on a minute, what about costs? And oh, hang on a second, what are we, I've just had this idea about the fact that we're going to need to write something about this, or, you know. And so you're all over this thing. But and so when linear people are trying to keep up with us, that they that's when they often think we're a bit crazy, like she's all over the place, you know. And so for me, now I understand that about my learning. Part of my learning is always explaining that to people so that they can just say, hang on, slow down, what? And I'll just slow down and explain that thing I'm doing and why I got from, you know, A to Z in 2 seconds flat just then. So learning, when it comes to trying to teach myself something, I will tend to do it in the same way, really. So I'll look at, you know, video clips sometimes, I'll look up on the web, and I tend to need time and I digest things because I'm aware that my brain's skirting on the outside of an onion in a way that I can't necessarily follow. And so I don't try to. I just know what I'm solving and I let my brain do what it needs to do and show me things, and I put things in front of myself, and then I'll get to the thing I'm trying to learn. So that's what I do. And then when it comes to sort of day-to-day learning and getting through things, I use lots of lists, bullet-pointed lists usually, and I love bullet journal paper, you know, that dotted paper. So that's one of my lists. You probably don't want to know what I'm doing today, but, you know, I'll tend to just do a bit of color, you know, lots of little checklists, and sometimes I have drawings on them, but usually it's just lists, and lists that aren't necessarily in a straight line. They'll be all over the place. So it was interesting actually learning about your bullet and technique of what you guys are doing, because it's actually quite similar but not the same as to what I do on an everyday basis. And so in order to learn something, I have to split it down, I have to do what I did with those tiny little cards for my O levels and strip it down to the bare minimum, and then I need to write it on a list so that I don't forget to think about that thing that was an idea I had 3 weeks ago that's actually quite important, but we're not at the point that we can do it yet, for example. So yeah, those are some of the things I do. I'm trying to think of any others. I probably can't some others in a minute.
So what's your experience of mind mapping? I love mind mapping. I love to hear what people's experience of mind mapping is. Mine has been a positive one, but other people with dyslexia often don't either know about it or they didn't have a positive experience about it or whatever. It's fascinating. What's your experience of mind mapping in your journey been?
Yeah, I don't use it much and I haven't used it much. I think it was a thing that came out when you know, I was an adult, and or maybe I just wasn't aware of it. And so it wasn't something I ever knew about when I was younger. And I think now that I've developed the ways that I learn, like those lists that I showed you, they're not really mind maps, but there's an element of that to them. That
visual organization is there.
Visual organization and the fact that it's not all in a straight line. The bits of it have got straight lines, but most of it hasn't. And there are often drawings, there isn't on this one I happen to have in front of me today, but you know, there are often little drawings on there. So it's not quite a mind map, but maybe it's towards that. Mm-hmm. But you know, I don't use mind maps actually, and I don't find I need to now. But I think as a child, I think it would have been really helpful. Eleanor uses them all the time. And she uses, are they called spider maps, where you just have one thing in the middle and then little legs off? She uses that all the time, even if it doesn't become a full mind map. So I think it's one of those things that if you know about it and you're shown about it young enough, I think it can be really helpful.
So let's talk about advice. Is there any advice you'd have given your teenage self if you could go back and give yourself a card? You know, what would the calligraphied message on the front be? And what would the message inside be? Would there be a message?
Do you know, it's funny. I was thinking about a time when I was at university. I had a moment where I really struggled. I still didn't know I was dyslexic. And I was trying to do some things that were really hard for me, like learn Italian, which was really difficult. Randomly, they had an Italian module on the course. Don't ask what that's got to do with industrial design. But anyway, but I went into my maths and statistics exam and all of the words were jumping around on the page. I couldn't read them. Very important exam. I tried to rush out of the room, but my maths teacher at the time stopped me and didn't let me leave the room and sat me down for 10 minutes and just said, go and do that paper and just read one word at a time. You'll be fine. And I was the only person that scored 100% in that exam. And, you know, it was ridiculous. And the reason I say that, not because I want you to know that I got 100% in that exam, was because what that taught me is what I would write on that card in my beautiful calligraphy pen, which was, just because you can't read the words of the question, it doesn't mean you can't do the question. You can. So your only hurdle is reading the words of it. Once you understand them, it's easy. So just because you can't read the words to that question, it doesn't mean that you can't actually do what that question's asking you. And that's quite an important point, really, because you can, you know, you can really go away from a subject or think you can't do something just because you've got the words in a muddle. And once you understand it, it's not gonna be any kind of barrier. And I mean, the other thing, maybe if I'm allowed two things on that piece of paper, because it has got two sides, is that actually we are so good at solving problems. And if you think of everything you do as solving a problem instead of, you know, I've got to write this sentence. You know, when I was writing the book that I wrote, it took me far too long. And it was because I tried to approach it like a normal person. And I tried to write it in a linear way. And it was just awful. And in the end, I just threw it all away and started again in a really random order. And I had this paragraph and that paragraph and this story and that story. And then I put them together like a dyslexic. And do you know what? I nailed it by doing it the way we do it. And so I think the other thing is, don't do things the way you think they should be done, because you've been told that by linear thinkers. Trust that you're going to do things differently, but it will be okay. I mean, every mum's got a story about their dyslexic kid. I don't understand it. He does so badly at school, and yet he's memorized all of the footballers in every single team. He knows their names. He knows their ages. What? You know, what? And then he won't bloody memorize his spellings. And I say that's because he cares about those. You know, when we want to do something, we can do anything. If we want to hard enough, we'll find those strategies. It'd be interesting to know what strategies that boy used to memorize those footballers. Because
we need to know those strategies.
So I think it's, you know, it's also just knowing that we can solve any problem. And that's a real strength of every dyslexic person that I've met, is problem solving. Sorry about my cat. and so, yeah, just know that your problem solving is actually what the real world's all about. And you're going to be good at that.
Okay. Advice to yourself as a parent then. If you were to go forwards or backwards, what advice would you give yourself?
As a parent to a dyslexic child, you mean? Mm-hmm. I think I just need to accept, rather like my mum did, that Eleanor's brain, even though she's dyslexic, it's not the same as mine. Mm-hmm. You know, she really struggles with maths, and I find that really hard to understand because I'm just like, just numbers, they're easy. And so, you know, so we're different, just like I was different from my mom. And just because she's dyslexic, we don't have the same kind of issues. So, you know, you're never going to understand your kids' brains, even if you happen to have the same kind of brain as them. And so what you do need to do is just try to give them the space to work things out for themselves, try and give them the support, and don't ever look, you know, think badly of them, like my mum did for you know, not being able to spell or something. You know, like I need to do the same for Ellen. I make a conscious effort not to think badly of the fact that she can't do maths, because she's so good at so many other things. Mm. Celebrate the things that you do well, that your kids do well, and actually just give the support and space for her. She's bright, she'll work out strategies for her maths, you know, trust that will happen.
So tools and gadgets you use for living with dyslexia. You've talked a little bit about your bullet journal paper there and your lists and so forth. Is there any other tools you have in your theoretical toolkit, as it were, whether they're techniques or actual physical tools? Or
I speak all of my text messages and WhatsApp messages, because we use that a lot at work, and speaking them rather than typing them is brilliant. So that's been important. I'm not sure if it's a technique or a tool or whatever it is, but a nice stationery really helps me. It doesn't have to be expensive, but it's very cheap. But, you know, having a lovely brush pen with two-ended nib so that I can write my little lists and colour them in, you know, having tools that I like to use, even when I'm doing something I don't like to do, makes me feel happy about those things. So that helps. I still use a lot of the techniques that, you know, I touch type all the time, because that's the way that I can communicate my emails. I still use, I don't use acronyms anymore to remember things, actually, but I still do use tiny cards for learning things as well. What else do I do? Yeah, I think mainly bullet journal paper, which is that one with all the dots. I love it. And I use that for everything, for drawing, for writing lists. So because that helps me when I see the page of dots, it helps me sort of think about in different directions. Yeah, that's all I can think of at the moment.
I have to ask you about jewellery. Tell us a little bit about dyslexia and jewellery. Does it give you an edge?
I think it gives everyone an edge in design, in all kinds of design, depending on what inspires you, because we find it very easy to think in three dimensions, especially if you've got a visual dyslexic brain. You know, for us, every time we look at a word, we treat it in the same way as we treat a picture, which means that we're probably using the wrong side of our brain to process it. And that does mean that we may struggle with that word, but it also means that the side of our brain that's actually processing pictures is massively highly developed. We can think in three dimensions without ever anybody having to say, this is one side of the shape, that the other side might look like this. But of course it does. You know, we don't, and people say things like, to dyslexic people, like, oh, you know, can you understand what the plan of that room would look like? If you imagine you're a person looking, I mean, it's just so obvious to us what the plan of a room will look like. And so all of those kind of visual design skills are really quite easy for a lot of dyslexic people. And so thinking in three dimensions, like, for example, you'll often find that dyslexic people, be interesting to know if you're like this, Darius, if they're packing a car to go on holiday, they know exactly to the millimeter how much luggage is going to fit in that car. And then they don't have to have anybody say that's one too many bags, because it's they know that can go in the car exactly. So I think when it comes to jewelry, you know, that is one type of design, and I think we're good at all types of design. And for me, I love jewelry because I love the color and I love the shapes and I love that it's personal and I love the stories it can tell. And, you know, thinking about that onion, I like all of the different things about it, and so that's what I enjoy telling people's love stories and life stories in the form of jewelry, really. So yeah, but I think that we're often quite good at design.
What advice would you give to children who are thinking about becoming jewelers?
I would say, remember that design, all kinds of design, not just jewelry design, isn't only about the artistic side of it. It's also quite scientific. So I need to know, for example, about gemology and materials. I need to know which metals are stronger than other metals, which stones are going to chip and which ones aren't. So whilst I'm drawing beautiful pictures, real design is not just that. That would be kind of like sculpture. Real design is also thinking this ring is an engagement ring, so it needs to last a lifetime, hopefully. You know, and so you know, actually understanding the materials you're working. So I often say to people who want to be jewelry designers, work hard at your art, but don't forget to work hard at your science as well. You need a bit of both to be a really good designer. There's some designers who've sort of lucked out and managed to get good, even though they're not very good at science, but you just need a bit of science and maths as well. Yeah.
That's fascinating. Harriet, thank you so much. It's been fantastic hearing your story.
Thank you for having me.
Hope you enjoyed that podcast with Harriet Kelsall, hearing her story as a jewellery designer and all her tips for getting through school and her challenges and her message of learning to focus on the positive rather than the negatives and celebrating what you do well. I've got a special treat for you as podcast listeners. We've developed an app. It's called the Dyslexia Quiz app. It's free. It's a free dyslexia screener. You just go to the Apple Store and download it. Search for Dyslexia Quiz. It will be up the top somewhere. Check out this quiz. We made it for you. It's great whether you identify with dyslexia or not. You might be wondering if you've got dyslexia or not and how much it's affecting your life. It's designed to explain the breadth that dyslexia can affect you and where it's affecting you, and you'll get a score at the end of the quiz with an explanation, and you can compare your score with your friends and family and see how they differ in the different areas of how it impacts reading, writing, remembering, tests, and planning. Thank you. Please like and leave a podcast review so other parents can find it. And if you're looking for study skills training, that's what we do at Bullet Map Academy. We help children organize their thoughts visually to unlock their potential with the world's first online dyslexia study skills school. We do one-to-one coaching online via Zoom. We do group coaching, and we have online training courses for children, teenagers, and adults. So go to bulletmapacademy.com. Go to one of our workshops or get a one-to-one, free one-to-one coaching session there and find out what it's all about. It can transform your life, make you more productive, save you time, and build up your confidence just by learning the right skills that match your way of thinking. See you in the next podcast. This podcast is sponsored by DyslexiaProductivityCoaching.com. It's my day job when I'm not hosting this podcast. Tell me, do you know what you want to achieve in the workplace, but you're struggling with how to achieve it? Maybe you suspect some traits of dyslexia are getting in the way. Well, that's where Dyslexia Productivity Coaching comes in, because we give you a simple productivity system for your Apple devices that harnesses the creativity that comes with your dyslexia. It includes proven methods like note-taking, reminders, speech-to-text, mind mapping, and more, all tailored to your needs. It'll free up your time and help you achieve outstanding results. Book a complimentary call to discuss it with me, and if you do it soon, I may also be available to coach you personally via Zoom. So don't be shy, go to dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com or swipe up and book it now.